Hello, it's Matthias, and welcome back to the AGA podcast. Trying something a little bit different this week. I can hear myself talking now, so hopefully I can keep an eye on... You can hear that. You can hear the cars revving outside. Sorry, I live right next to a busy street, and my computer is currently set up right next to a big old door that leads outside to a patio, though I don't think anywhere I move my computer would really help that. But this week, we're going to be talking about Pulse from 2001, a Japanese horror film. I felt like I needed to maybe talk about a Japanese film to actually justify the title of this podcast. Also, I'm feeling like a little under the weather. I can like hardly breathe through my nose right now, so apologies for that. Though this is, I'm currently recording this on Sunday, which might change in the future. I might start recording on Saturdays, and then I'm releasing this tomorrow, pretty much. But before we actually get into the movie, I felt might be a little bit necessary to potentially talk about like how I want to talk about movies. You know, I feel that anyone should enjoy what they enjoy. You know, your favorite movie is your favorite movie, and no one should ever look down on you for that. You know, there might be a world where I potentially disagree, or, you know, I can at least articulate what I don't like about films. Though this podcast is a platform for me to talk about the films I enjoy and the films that I want to share with people. So if there's an episode made on a film on this podcast, it is worth checking out, in my opinion. I feel it holds some sort of weight, some sort of entertainment value that I would like to pass on to you. Even if the movie isn't the greatest, you know, I have movies over on my shelf. I kind of talked about this last week, but I have a shelf over 400 Blu-rays, but I have some movies over on that shelf that I would consider very bad movies, but also at the same time, they would be something I consider very entertaining, and the history and kind of where they came from is interesting to me. I don't know if we'll ever talk about it, but I have a movie over on my shelf called Wicked World, and it was one of those movies, I think it was made in the 90s. I want to say late 90s, but I'd be completely wrong. It was a directorial debut of a person who's making movies to this day. I really wish I was more prepared to talk about this because I do not remember their name, but you could look it up, Wicked World. They have a Blu-ray through the America Film Genre Archive, AFGA, which they released like kind of a bunch of like small obscure movies. I should probably buy more from them, but another movie I own from them is McPherson Tape, which one of these days we will talk about. But Wicked World is like a directorial debut of somebody, and the film was like, I don't know if it was never meant to be released or, you know, just was never released, but all these years later, you know, it finally comes out and it's on Blu-ray and it's widely available for people to see, and I really like stories like that. Like there's a movie I own from the Criterion collection called Vampyr. There's a movie made back in the 30s, I believe, black and white German film about vampires that was lost for a really long time, and then somebody found like a French cut of it and kind of put it all back together and commissioned new. There's like these screens that kind of tell you what's going on in the story. Again, I don't find that movie entertaining, but I do appreciate the history and I do appreciate how it's now widely available. A movie who's been, you know, gone for a really long time. The same could be said for something like Metropolis. A movie that it's very long. I think it's about 2.5 hours long. It's a German silent film, but for the longest time, it was cut up to oblivion, and a full cut of it didn't exist until they found some reels in a film archive in Argentina, and then it was like the first time the film had ever been like complete as it is. The Blu-ray you can get from Amazon is $20, and it's the most complete version of Metropolis we'll probably ever have. And even then, I could do a whole episode on the history of Metropolis, probably, maybe a shorter one. And I find that stuff very fascinating. You know, as I said last week, I'm going to school for film history and criticism. I tend to err on the side of film history than criticism, but this podcast is a little bit of a way, I guess, to help exercise that criticism part for me. But I tend to just like movies. I don't like to force myself to watch movies. I kind of wait until I'm in the mood, so I'm not necessarily like... I'm looking for the word. I don't want to force myself to watch a movie because I feel like I'll be in the wrong headspace and walk away, maybe not enjoying it as much as I would. Like Pulse, the movie we're talking about today, I rewatched it last night for this episode. It's my second time seeing it, and I definitely enjoyed it the second time over, or second time watching it. Apologies. It was one of those movies where, and this is kind of something I've learned about the director, Kiyoshi Kurosawa, the person who directed Pulse and another movie called Cure, is that the first time through his movies, there's kind of almost like a lot to take in, and you might not walk away from it fully understanding, but on the second time through, I kind of picked up on a little bit more things, and it was just a little bit more cohesive to me, and I go, oh, okay, this is why the ending is like it is, because I remember not enjoying the ending, and that might be something we get to eventually. I'm kind of debating, like last week, I'm kind of debating how I want to talk about this movie. This might not necessarily be a little bit of a plot breakdown. It might be a lot like last week, but there's just like a lot to say, even when it comes to not plot, when it comes to even cinematography. And the way that I watched this movie the last time is something that is something I usually don't do. And we'll get to that in a moment. But I, again, as I said, I'm talking about movies on this podcast because I want people to watch them. And that being said, if you have Max, or what was known as HBO Max, you can watch this movie on Max. It is on there. Please watch the 2001 version. I believe there was an American version released in 2006. I don't know much about that movie. I could probably do a future episode talking about the mid-2000s and their kind of obsession with adapting J-horror and even sometimes Korean horror films over to the United States. The mid-2000s, when it comes to horror in general, especially like American-made horror, is weird and not a whole lot of standouts, at least in my head. It's of its own era. And you can kind of say that of any era, but the constant kind of like remaking of Japanese horror films to bring to an American audience. I don't know. A lot of people say like nowadays Hollywood is a little, did not mean to slam my desk that hard. People say like on nowadays that Hollywood is a little bit bankrupt. But I don't know. I just feel like it's a thing that has been happening for a really long time. And it's something I've kind of mulled over, that I'm kind of curious if, like, as a generation, people just kind of come to understand that, even though it's been a long truth. You know, we could talk about probably remakes. There's even remakes spanning all the way back to the 50s, you know. One that I have over on my shelf that I wanted to watch the other day, but, you know, again, don't like forcing myself to watch movies, so I didn't. I have a collection of two Japanese films. One's a silent film made in the 30s called A Story of Floating Weeds. And then the same director remade that movie in the 50s called Floating Weeds. And so, you know, it's one of those things. We've been remaking movies for years. Adaptations have been a thing for years. Even if you want to talk about stuff like, you know, Tim Burton's Batman or Jurassic Park, those are both adaptations. But, you know, I do think proper, I don't know, it's a really weird and complicated thing to talk about. Because to say that there are no good movies being released nowadays is just, I think people hear that and go along with it and don't actually sit down and watch movies. Something like this year I watched Strange Darling, and it was a really good thriller that was told out of order, and it was very unique, and it was very well written, and it was something I very much enjoyed. So I don't know, to say that there are no good movies ever being released, there's things like Long Legs that was released earlier this year, a horror film directed by Osgood Perkins that I think the Blu-ray comes out sometime this month, and I might have to go pick that up because I really did enjoy that. So to say that there are no good movies in a flood of like Marvel and things like that, and I don't even want to like sit here and like I watched Deadpool and Wolverine and I enjoyed it really a lot. I went and saw Beetlejuice and I enjoyed that a lot. So I'm not here to like gatekeep movies or anything like that. I'm not here to like look down on anyone for their opinion on movies, because it's a medium that has been around for such a long time and people have their different tastes. It's like music, you know, you can't get mad if somebody liking country music if you don't like country music. So that's kind of where my philosophy is when it comes to talking about movies. Also, another thing, like my most hyped movie for this year is like Sonic the Hedgehog 3. So, you know, there might be some people who are like, that movie's for kids. Why would you like that movie? I'm not going to lie. I watched the trailer. I'm hyped as shit for that movie. So, again, you know, my movie tastes are everywhere. I enjoy most things that I watch. And even then, there are some things that, you know, I don't particularly enjoy. I sat down and watched Alfred Hitchcock's Psycho. That was made back in the 60s. And while I did enjoy it, there's something about 60s movies, and I think it's in the pacing. Obviously, we're not here to talk about Psycho, and eventually I will start talking about Pulse, I promise. But it's my podcast, so get over it. when it comes to, like, most 60s movies, I feel like the beginnings are, like, super solid and really well-paced and, like, get you hooked, and then there's just, like, this really big lull in the center of it, and then it kind of, like, jumps back up at the end. And that's how I kind of felt about Psycho. All the stuff with, I think her name was Miriam, the girl who steals the money in the very beginning, was, like, super fascinating. I was super hooked. And then you meet Norman Bates, and then she dies, and then it's just kind of like a slow decline of, like, interest throughout the movie. So, you know, there are things that I don't, there are some eras of movies that I'm not particularly fond of, though I, you know, not to say like every movie from the 60s is bad, because I did watch Whatever Happened to Baby Jane, and I really enjoyed that movie. It still fell into the same trappings that I have of most 60s movies when it comes to pacing, but that story and the acting and the performances definitely got me through that movie, and I think it's a little bit of a longer one. I think it's around the 2-hour mark. And it was one of those ones that, also, take breaks during movies, you know? If you're watching a 2-hour movie and you start it at like 7 o'clock and you go, get about halfway through and you go, oh, I'm not really feeling this right now, turn it off, come back the next day. That's something I've been trying to get into the habit of, especially with longer movies. Not everyone has time to sit and watch a 2.5-hour long movie, you know? We're here to talk about Pulse. Again, it's available on Max. It's available on most services to rent. Fairly cheap, fairly accessible, unlike last week's movie that I talked about, The Resurrected, which is like only available on some DVDs and Blu-rays and like nowhere to stream. And I don't know if I talked about this yet, but I think most movies I will be talking about from my actual collection will be from my actual collection. So there are things that I own, things that I, again, enjoy. But go and watch this movie. You know, pause this. I don't know how long this episode's going to be. Probably around the hour mark. We're about 15 minutes in so far. But pause this. Go watch the movie, you know? And then come back and we'll have a conversation about it. And Pulse is kind of one of those movies where you go, what happened? I don't fully, like, get what happened. Come back and maybe I can help you, understand a little bit more. I just want you to watch movies. So go watch this movie and come back. One thing I will say that I did a little differently, as much as I love my Blu-ray collection, this movie, the Arrow release that I have, let's see if I can see, maybe 2017, it looks like this came out. I did not buy this in 2017. I bought it a couple years later. I think this is still fairly accessible, this Arrow release. But something that was kind of unique about this release is that it came with a DVD and a Blu-ray, which I feel like is kind of harder nowadays to find. But I sat down and I went, I'm going to watch this in DVD. As much as I like Blu-ray, this is a 2001 film that back in 2001, when it would have been originally released, it would have been on DVD. And oh boy, am I glad I watched this on DVD. Max is probably the Blu-ray cut, the like 1080p version of it. I know Amazon, you can rent the like SD version for fairly cheap. I think like $3, $4. If you can, watch this in standard definition. I think it adds so much to this movie, and it's a movie such of its time. To boil down this movie, it's about internet ghost. ghosts are haunting my internet, which I say that, and all my like icons on my desktop right now are flickering in and out. Ooh, spooky ghost. The ghosts are haunting my computer now. But to say that this movie, as I said, to boil it down to a very surface level explanation, internet ghost. And that's why I kind of say it's of its time. This was made in 2001, or I should say released in 2001, probably made in 2000, maybe a little earlier. But the internet's still fairly new, you know. I don't know if Y2K was a big thing in Japan. It might have been, who knows. But, you know, we're 1 year. This was released in February of 2001. So, you know, we're really only a year past Y2K. And for context, I'm 25. I was born in 99. So I do not have any memory of Y2K. I've only, you know, I've seen things post, popular media about Y2K. And I think there's even a movie. I don't know if it's a horror movie. I don't think it's a horror movie. I think it's a comedy about Y2K coming out fairly soon. I heard something about it and maybe saw like a teaser trailer. But that might be something I have to like look into. But yeah, again, internet's still fairly new. Not everyone knows how it works. Even the intro of the introduction of one of our characters in this movie is him setting up internet for the first time. And, you know, I could never imagine, you know, because I kind of grew up in a time where the internet was still. I'm trying to think of when I got my first computer. I remember the memory of it was given to me for Christmas. And like I went into like the like what eventually became the office, and there was like a computer there waiting for me. And I'm really trying to think, that might have been like late elementary, middle school for me. I didn't get my first like phone with internet until I think I was 10. And even then, that might have been a little bit too young. Though I don't think social media was as rampant when I was 10, because I was 10 in 2009 and I didn't really even have access to that stuff. It was more like YouTube for me. That's kind of what I grew up with. I don't think you could get a Facebook until you're 13. And I don't think I got a Facebook until I was 13. I might've been 12. And I didn't have Twitter until high school. And, Twitter is both are Facebook and Twitter kind of their own separate cesspools of different things, but I kind of digress. But again, this feels such of its time. This is all about the internet and kind of the uncertainty of the internet, and I think a lot of it comments on anonymity on the internet, isolation, even depression. When I go to talk about movies like this, I tend to not look at other people's reviews or other people's interpretations of the film, mainly because I want to come in with my own interpretations and what I got away from the movie. But it is definitely a movie about isolation, a little bit about anonymity and, you know, depression and what the internet, you know, can do, and how some people do think that you're not really connected on the internet. You might be able to meet people and talk to people on the internet. And I do believe that it's correct to a certain degree. While I'm in a I just moved to Albuquerque not that long ago, and I think I talked about this in the last episode. You know, a lot of my friends currently are people I met on the internet and I've talked to for years on the internet. So I do consider those people my friends, even though I've never really met them, but I've talked to them for years now. Though it doesn't quite replace a in-person connection. I will say that to that degree. And, you know, some people are really one side of the fence where it's like, no, you can't make friends on the internet. And I guess it just totally depends on probably like the time you grew up and what you consider a friend and things like that. But I digress. This movie is going to be interesting to talk about, because we have like two big, we have kind of like two storylines that intersect, I would say, with 20 minutes left in this movie. So we're going to talk about Kiyoshi Kurosawa a little bit, the director of this film. Apparently, this is the Japanese title for this film, I believe, is called Kairo, which just means circuit, I believe, in Japanese. And it's based off a book that he wrote called Kairo. I really tried to research this book. I couldn't really find much. I've seen pictures of it. It's not on like Kindle or anything. I don't think it's ever been translated. I think it might have been translated into French, and we'll kind of get into maybe why that was translated into French a little late. Well, we'll talk about that here in a little bit. So I can't find really much information about this book. It might have been while he was making direct-to-video films, he wrote this book, and eventually it became a movie. It's really hard to say. I watched a little bit of an interview with him. He didn't really talk about it. So it's kind of hard to say, but Kiyoshi Kurosawa also directed another film that I really enjoy called Cure. And one of these days we'll talk about Cure, but I don't know if I am ready to talk about Cure. It's a movie I definitely want to rewatch. And I think on my second viewing, I'll get a little bit of a misunderstanding, but Cure is a lot more philosophical and a lot more dialogue heavy compared to Pulse. Pulse is fairly simple to get the hang of. When it comes to its concepts, Cure, on the other hand, is a lot of back and forth, kind of philosophical kind of speaking and super long takes. So not sure if I'm quite ready to talk about that one yet. But Kiyoshi Kurosawa kind of got his start in what's called pink film, which is kind of like exploitation, nudity, potentially like sexual aspects to the film. And that's how he got his start. Eventually he moved on to direct to video film. Sorry, I don't know why it's so hard for me to say that. And that's where he met Sho Aikawa and worked with him a lot. He talks about it in the interview of the Blu-ray that I was talking about. He met him, and apparently he makes a little bit of a cameo in this movie. I didn't really spot him, though also I wasn't really looking for him, because this is stuff I learned after the fact. I typically sit down, watch the movie, and then watch special features afterwards. I feel it's just a little bit better to do it that way. That way I have a little bit of a fresher grasp on the film. And also, typically special features can lead to spoilers, and I like to go into movies blind for the most part. There might be some screenshots I've seen of a movie that makes me go out and seek it, or a small little clip. That's what happened with a Japanese movie I now own called Zairem. I saw a small little clip of a really cool scene in that, and I went off and I watched it because of that. And then also, there's a few people of note that aren't actually main characters in this. Koji Yakusho plays a ship captain. He is the main character of Cure. He was in a movie called Happiest Days, which I have the Blu-ray of. I still need to watch. It's a Wim Wenders movie, which he made, Paris, Texas. Probably his most popular one. What else? Is there anything I want to say about Kiyoshi Kurosawa? He just released a new film that I don't think is available yet. I think it just did its film festival circuit, and I don't remember the name of it, but I'll probably watch it when it comes out. All right, sorry about that. Took a little bit of a break. But I guess we can actually kind of move into the basic plots of this movie. Again, it's going to be a little weird because there is two separate stories that kind of mix in together. I'm going to talk about our first story here, which follows a character called Michi Kudo. We're just going to call her Michi, played by Kumiko Aso. She's just moved to Tokyo. Most of this movie, I believe, takes place in Tokyo. She's a, I don't want to say a botanist, but a person who just sells plants. And there is Taguchi in the beginning, played by Kenji Mizuhashi. She talks about him, like, messing around with a disc. Sorry, I'm going to bring up... for full disclosure, I do bring up the Wikipedia when I talk about this stuff. That way I kind of I know that I'm following the general course of the plot. But if you have gone and watched the movie and come back, then I like to have these up to kind of keep me on track. That way a person like you who has just watched the movie, hopefully, and come back will be like, wait, that's not how it went. So Michi goes, Michi is like, hey, where's Taguchi? He's working on this disc and it's been like 3 days and we haven't really seen him. No one can get a hold of him. And so Michi is like, I'll go over to his house and see how he's doing. I have to talk about the look of this film because it's, I think, very intentional, obviously, where it's kind of one word to kind of describe it is like dirty. Nothing's like really clean in this movie and everything's kind of like muted and dull and kind of like grays and browns. And I think me watching it on like a 480 version of it on DVD, not like, you know, HD or anything like that, really adds to that feel and like texture and kind of time period it was made in. It's filmed on like very grainy film that gives it this like really nice texture where not a whole lot of things are clear. It's not like a super crisp image or anything like that. And that kind of adds to, I think, a lot of the themes. One, I think, is kind of anonymity because there's a lot of face covering in this movie, a lot of not being able to see like a ghost face completely. Or there's a scene later on where somebody jumps from the top of this water tower and the entire time she's falling, she's covering her face. So just small things like that. And also red is used, a lot throughout this movie, especially when we get to what's known as forbidden rooms. And there's these doors that are, the edges of them are completely sealed in red tape. And there's even a lot of like, if you kind of look, there's a lot of scenes of, you know, as I said, there are these like very muted colors and it's very brown or very gray. And like red just kind of sticks out, whether it be like red wires or the red words of a package of food or small things like that, that sprinklings of red throughout. But she goes over to Taguchi's house and she's like, hey, where's this disc at? And he's like, oh, it's over there. You can, I guess that's not quite true at first. Okay. Sorry, I had to take a little bit of a break. As I said, like, my nose is, like, super stuffed. And I don't think I'm used to the altitude of New Mexico yet. So I think, like, breathing for me is kind of hard right now. And especially with, like, kind of a stuffy nose. It's kind of, especially as I'm talking, I'm trying not to talk too fast here. Which I felt like I maybe fell into a little bit last week, was talking too fast. So I'm trying to take it a little bit slow. But as I was saying, when Michi first goes to Taguchi's apartment, she doesn't see him right away. There's this like clear plastic tarp that's in the background and you can just kind of see like his shadow sitting there. And she's like calling his name and he just doesn't move. And it's almost like a robot. Eventually he just gets up and it's like, oh, hey, yeah, I'm here. Oh, yeah, you can go and... you know, the disc is over there. And she's like, oh, we should label these things because she's looking through. One thing I will say about this movie, anytime anyone is about to walk off frame, and I think, thinking back to the movie, oh, I kind of forgot about how this movie opens. This movie opens on a boat, but it's not quite important to the plot until later on. It's one of those ones where it starts at this boat and then goes backwards. But it's not really too important. We'll get to the boat. Maybe. That's if I want to talk about the ending of this movie. Which maybe I should, if I'm here to clarify some things. But anytime anyone walks off screen in this movie, you kind of get scared for them. And I think the ending kind of plays into that a little bit. But as she's looking for this disc, Taguchi walks off screen and she's like, hey, where'd you go? And she walks around the corner, and this is the only time you really ever see something horrific like this, but he kills himself. And the effect of his neck with like the noose around his neck is kind of harrowing to look at. And something you kind of learn about people who kill themselves in this movie, they leave behind this like black spot where their body is. And I think it's such good imagery, especially for anyone who has ever lost someone. I think maybe when you look at those places, that's just kind of what you see, is the shadow of them. So I think that's a very good, really good imagery to kind of signify that somebody used to be there and that they're just kind of gone now. And that's just kind of the last place you ever saw them. And so the cops are called. Again, I'm not gonna maybe go beat by beat per se. I'll probably hit on the biggest story points, but she eventually goes out, and I think around this time is when we get to the introduction of Ryosuke Kawashima, which is played by Haruhiko Kato, which is something I kind of forgot to talk about in the intro of this. This film went to Cannes. When I said that Cairo was looked like it was translated into French, that might be why. It might have had a really big scene in France, because it was popular enough to go to Cannes, which is a French film festival, which is like kind of one of the big institutions of film festivals. Like, if your movie does well at Cannes, it's usually going to get distributed. It's usually going to, you know, at the front of the box, like, you know, winner of two awards at Cannes Film Festival, or, you know, things like that. So that's like the big one. And this film went to Cannes. And I do believe it was Kiyoshi Kurosawa, the director, and Haruhiko Kato, who plays Kawashima. We're going to call him Kawashima. That's kind of how he's referred to in the movie. No one ever really calls him Ryosuke. But this is kind of where we get to Kawashima. And as I said, kind of the intro of this, he's setting up his computer. It's kind of very AOL-esque. He's like looking in this booklet. As I kind of said earlier, I've never had experienced this, but I'm sure maybe some of the somebody who might be a little bit older than me listening to this, you know, remember setting up their first computer and setting up things like AOL and having to flip through a book to be like, how do I use this thing? Where nowadays it just feels so second nature to go on a computer and look up, you know, whatever you want to look up, especially when it comes to smartphones nowadays. When it comes to smartphones, it's just a computer in your pocket. You know, I can pull out my phone at any point and message somebody or Google whatever I need to Google. But besides the point, as I said, it is very of its time. Computers are new. So he sets up his computer and he gets some error messages, and eventually it goes through. And this is kind of where we get our first, actually, I don't want to say like our first horror bit, because I might have skipped over something. I can't quite remember the structure of this film, but that's okay. I'm not here to particularly give a play-by-play breakdown the entire plot, but as he finishes, also this guy's a gamer. When he's introduced in this film, it's him like pushing off all these like video games off of his like desktop, and he has like, in one scene you can see like a guide for Quake and things like that. So this guy's a gamer, which I appreciate. But when he finishes booting it up, it like his computer goes black and it opens up, and it's like, it says, do you want to see a ghost? And This is where we get into a point where he's cycling through, and when it comes to these photos or these like live streams, I don't know if these are people who are still alive and just have cameras on, or if these are or if these are looking into those forbidden rooms and these are the ghosts that are inhabiting them. It's never really fully explained how these cameras kind of work, and it's never fully explained also. It's never fully explained where how people know about these forbidden rooms and how to tape up these forbidden rooms. And that's kind of where we, I think there are further things that are developed within Kawashima's storyline, but we're going to pause right there and go back to Michi's storyline. Again, I'm going to be jumping back and forth quite a bit between these two storylines. I don't think I'm jumping back and forth quite the same as the movie, but, you know, again, one man show. I only have my own memory to rely off of. I don't take notes during movies or anything like that. So we go back and we find Michi finds the disc, and there are two coworkers and a boss. The boss is, I didn't write his name down, unfortunately. He plays a little bit of a lesser part in these movies, I would say. Though I guess he does tape up a forbidden room at some point in time, which I don't know if you have to be possessed by a ghost to do that or how people learn about these forbidden rooms, as I said. Though Michi takes this disc to her two co-workers, Toshio Yabe, which is played by Masatoshi Matsuo, and Junko Sasano, which is played by Kurumi Arisaka. We're just going to refer to them as Yabe and Junko. Yabe's a male, Junko's a female. And Michi's female, Kawashima's male. But on this disc is a scene of, and it's composed so well. It's a scene of Taguchi facing his computer, but on one of the screens is the exact same photo that they're looking at. So it kind of creates, I don't want to say it creates an infinite one, because you can only ever really see the photo on the screen. And then there's also a face in the screen, like a ghostly face in one of the screens. And they all kind of look at this. And then eventually it kind of goes off to Yabe. And I think Yabe is looking through Taguchi's, and it's actually a really good scene now that I think about it. I was looking through Taguchi's stuff in his apartment, and there's a scene where, again, there's that like black shape on the wall that got left when Taguchi killed himself there. And there's a scene where Yabe is exploring his apartment, and he looks at that space and he walks off. And for whatever reason, I don't know whatever compels him to like walk back, but he walks back and Taguchi is standing there, and he's like, "What happened?" And eventually Taguchi vanishes again. And he finds a note somewhere in Taguchi's apartment talking about these forbidden rooms. It says, "Don't enter the forbidden room." And so as Yabe is leaving Taguchi's apartment, he comes across a forbidden room, which, as I said, it's this like red, it's this door with red tape all around the edges of the door to seal it shut. And, you know, it's such a, Kiyoshi Kurosawa seems to really like his, like, iconography, if you could call it that, where in Cure, it's an X that gets left on the victim's chest, these, like, giant X's, and then this, I would say, it's these forbidden rooms, which are these, like, red taped-up rooms. And for whatever reason, Yabe is compelled to go into this room. And this is where you kind of learn that these ghosts exist inside these rooms, because he, and in a scene that is, I don't know, kind of masterfully crafted, he encounters a ghost in this room. And of note, I should say, when Kawashima is going through all those cameras, he comes across a person with a black trash bag over his face in a wheelchair. And I think you learn this later, but I believe the words behind him say help in Japanese, which help is a thing that kind of comes across. And of note, the whole reason Yabe goes over to Taguchi's, again, I'm looking at the Wikipedia article to make sure I'm getting all these details correct. Taguchi gets a call, what he thinks is from, or my bad, Yabe gets a call from what he thinks is Taguchi saying, help me, in this like kind of digitally distorted voice. And so that's what compels him to go over to the apartment. So when he walks in, I do believe there's writing on the wall, and I think it's the help me writing, or it could just be, maybe in this one, not so much, as it's just kind of like just a smearing of red all over the wall. And he turns around, and I think the way that they shot this ghost scene, I think she's, I think they filmed it backwards, because she, like, the way she's walking is very uncannily, like, very uncanny. And it feels very Twin Peaks when they're in the Red Room. I know all the Red Room stuff is filmed in reverse to give it that uncanny feel. And this kind of feels the same way. The way she's walking is very exaggerated. And at one point she stumbles. And the way that she stumbles, it feels like it was shot in reverse. But again, this is one of those scenes where I kind of talk about the anonymity of kind of the internet and what that brings you. Because a lot of these ghosts, you can't really see their face. And when you do, that's what makes people kind of go crazy. But this scene in particular, like, builds this feeling of dread that you don't want to see this ghost face. Like, it helps really sell the point of, if I see this ghost face, something bad might happen to me. And so the entire time you're just, like, watching this, and there's a YouTube video kind of breaking down the scene. If I can find it, I'm going to put it in the comments down below. But he eventually hides behind a couch, Yabe being that person, hides behind the couch and looks under it and notices that she's gone. And he looks up and over this couch, like the ghost, like kind of like slowly reveals her face and looks down at him, and he screams and eventually runs out. And you kind of learn that after people experience these ghosts, they kind of act differently. And there's like a feeling of dread upon them. And I think this is where the whole idea of depression on the internet kind of exists. Because as a minor spoiler, Kawashima meets a character named Yoshizaki, which is played by Shinji Takeda, which during the same year was in a movie called Happiness of the Katakuris, a Takashi Miike film, which is like one of my favorite films of all time. It's a Japanese horror musical. One of my favorite films of all time. I have a tattoo of it. Really good. Highly recommend. Speaking of tattoo, I should probably put some lotion on my new tattoo. But you kind of learn that their theory is that when somebody dies, their spirit inhabits a realm. And they aren't sure of how many... You know, they're assuming that this realm is overflowing and these ghosts need somewhere to go. So they're coming out in these devices to haunt these specific rooms, and that they're overflowing into our world through the internet. And so when I kind of talk about how seeing these ghosts can kind of like lead to a depression that I believe has people taking their own lives, and how that kind of relates to, I think we see it more nowadays than back in 2001, though, I could be completely wrong about how, I think especially even social media nowadays, people see how well other people are doing and maybe get a little bit depressed, you know, especially following things like celebrities where it's like, oh, they're living the dream. They get to act in movies and they have millions of dollars, but they're such a small percentage of the population. You know, I would say most, you know, most people are going to work a 9-to-5 until they retire, and, you know, hopefully retirement doesn't go up, but that's a completely different thing. But most people are going to work a 9-to-5 for the rest of their lives, you know, and not particularly stand out in the world. And I know that it can be a little bit of a depressing thought, but I think that is the norm. And so when people see things like celebrities on social media, they get depressed because it's like, well, I'm not doing that, you know, or even beauty standards, nowadays are a little bit ridiculous, and I think that can lead to a bit of depression. And sometimes, you know, even things like online bullying can lead to suicide, and it's a very tragic thing. And I think this movie is ahead of its time when kind of commenting on stuff like that. Again, I wasn't a Japanese I wasn't a Japanese teenager in 2001, so I can't necessarily speak on the the Japanese experience in 2001. I can't really speak on anyone's experience with the internet in 2001. But I can kind of speak on my experiences nowadays and just what I've seen. And this, as I said, this movie feels really ahead of its time when it comes to that. But Junko and Michi, after this situation, notices Yabe is, you know, acting weird, is very cold. He kind of goes missing for a day, I believe. Or he goes missing for a certain amount of time where it makes them like worried. And I was reading my little outline, but becomes very cold towards them and doesn't really say much. And there's only very few times that he actually ever speaks to the characters again in any certain way. Which makes sense, this place they sell plants takes place on the roof, and there's like some really cool imagery with that. There's a scene, I believe it's here, where like Michi is standing on the side, and there's this kind of like tarp blowing into her face, and it feels much like the tarp in Taguchi's apartment, where it kind of, it doesn't hide her face per se, but it feels very intentional in that way, where it is something that can hide one's face. And I do believe that this is around the time where Michi sees that girl jump off the top of, I don't want to say it's like a water tower, but she jumps and she's covering her face the entire time. Which those, as I said, I keep bringing this up, but a lot of hidden faces in this film. But we can go back to Kawashima, because I do believe this stuff happens way later after the Kawashima stuff. Okay, sorry about that again. Feeling a little under the weather and need to catch my breath every now and then. I feel like the air is like kind of weirdly thin today, but we're gonna bounce back to Kawashima's story. He goes to college. You learn that he's, I believe, like an economics major, but he goes to college and he ends up meeting Harue Karasawa, played by Kyoki. I think that's a stage name, or if she just goes by one name. Didn't really do too much diving into that, but we'll call her Harue. Harue? I really hope I'm saying that correctly. That's like one name I'm not 100% confident on. But Kawashima and Harue. She's a teacher, and she says, when this happens again, the whole, like, have you seen a ghost, and all the cameras and such. She says, oh, try to bookmark it. Try to print screen it. And I do appreciate, because Kawashima has nothing to do with computers. He's like, whoa, you're going too fast for me. Something, you know, bookmarking a website or print screening something might be seen as super simple, but as a person who just doesn't know anything about computers, like, whoa, you're going way too fast for me. To the point where he actually has to sit down and write down everything she says. But eventually he does that. He gets back to that website and sees all these photos again, and he can't bookmark it, so he hits print screen and goes back the next day. And I do believe this is where we learn of this post-grad simulation where it's like supposed to be people. And it's these small little white dots that are meant to mimic people. And eventually later on we learn that there are these like ghost dots that show up. I don't think much ever comes of this. Little simulation thing. At least not that I can remember. Though, eventually, as I said, you know, they kind of have a back and forth. And I think these two are probably the strongest relationship of it. You can tell Kawashima really cares for Harue. And, you know, is constantly looking out for her. And it starts off, like, innocent enough, but Harue kind of, like, spirals towards the end of this, where I do believe in the scene that we meet Yoshizaki. She's like, here, let me come over, and, oh, no, apologies. No, it's not. She comes over before, I believe, we meet him, but she comes over to see the internet or to see the website and look at, like, probably whatever he print screened. And that's where we kind of get the idea that she says, you know, she asked him, like, why did he get the internet? He's like, I don't know, really. Like, everyone's just kind of doing it, so I figured I'd try it out myself. And this movie makes the internet kind of scary, and I know the internet in general can potentially be a scary place at some points, but this one a little bit more so. I can't remember if it's before or after this, but there are plenty of scenes of with Kamishima, the computer just turns on in the middle of the night on its own, and as I said, you know, there's ghosts in my computer, and it starts going through those screens that he keeps seeing, and she comes over and kind of introduces, like, you know, did you want to feel connected to people? And he's like, not really in particular. And she says, well, I don't, you know, the internet might make you feel connected, but I think we're truly alone. And she kind of brings up this point of isolation. And we'll get into that a little bit later, especially when it comes to Harue's character. When it comes to the internet and isolation and people closing themselves off from the outside world just to be on the internet. But we'll get to that a little later. They meet up a couple of times in the school and kind of have a conversation back and forth, just developing their, you know, relationship. And, you know, eventually Harue gives Kawashima her number. And then this is when we meet Yoshizaki. And there's a scene with Yoshizaki and Kawashima where they're in the library and there's like a ghost. Essentially what we learn is a ghost peeking through the outside of the bookshelf. And Yoshizaki is like, if you can catch it, you might be able to figure out what it is. But people usually don't catch it. If you start now, you might be able to. And he runs over and the ghost goes back behind the bookcase and completely disappears. And, you know, Kawashima throughout the movie is very much a person who, he says that even if he sees a ghost, he won't believe in it. You know, he's a skeptic. He doesn't quite believe in ghosts. He's kind of he talks about it later in the film, but he says he wants to live forever. And why should we think about death right now? Like, it's so far away. And in our lifetime, in 10 to 15 years, they'll make a pill where we can live forever. And, you know, we're in 2024 and it's been 23 years and here we are. But that's where Yoshizaki kind of gives this explanation of, I should say, his theory of ghosts are leaking into our world from the internet, and they kind of inhabit any device that they possibly can. And this is kind of, proven at some point in the movie. The boss of the flower shop just kind of goes missing at some point. And he's one of the people who seals up a forbidden room. And again, it's not really explained how these people know about forbidden rooms, but he seals up a forbidden room at a construction site, and eventually they knock it down, and you see that in the forbidden room there's an Ethernet port, kind of implying that these ghosts are getting in through Ethernet ports into our world. And I guess this would be a good time to jump back into Michi's storyline, to kind of help wrap that up, because, you know, we're about to hit the hour mark here. But to wrap up Michi's storyline before it intersects with Kawashima, we have a little bit more to talk about with Kawashima. But Junko, after Yabe dies and leaves a black stain, Junko goes into a forbidden room and Michi saves Junko from this forbidden room. And this is so creepy. There's like a ghost in there, and like its hair is kind of like standing up. You can kind of tell it's like a female, but its hair is kind of standing up as it's like standing over Junko, and Junko is just like screaming at this ghost. And Michi eventually saves Junko and takes her home and is taking care of her, but it's already too late. Like, Michi falls asleep and Junko is like, do you think I'll die like this? And Michi is like, no, you got plenty of time to live. Like, you'll be fine. And she's like, yeah, maybe I'll just die alone like this. And this is one of those things. She walks off screen and then becomes a black spot in the wall. So I don't know if, because The weird thing is that even with Yabe, you don't see him explicitly kill himself like Taguchi. Taguchi is like hanging there and then becomes a black spot. But people like Yabe and Junko just kind of like fade into the wall and become a black spot. And at some point these black spots start like, I think you see this the first time with Junko, but these black spots kind of turn into these little dots and kind of like fly away. And this is, again, Michi just moved to Tokyo and her mom lives outside of Tokyo, but she calls her mom after Junko dies. And, I can't remember if she hears the help me from her mom and that's what causes her to leave Tokyo. Cause I guess Kawashima isn't in Tokyo from what I'm reading. Cause the way that they intersect, she's leaving Tokyo. It could still be in Tokyo. There's very like dialogue is like, yeah, we live in Tokyo. When it comes to Michi, it's not really 100% established that where Kawashima lives. Again, I'm not an expert in Japan. Maybe if I knew a little bit more about Japan, I would know the region that he was from. But again, not an expert. So I'm just going to assume he also lives in Tokyo. But that's kind of where Michi's storyline wraps up. Hers is a little bit more of a simple storyline. It's not too in-depth. I would say Kawashima and Harue's story is kind of the more solid one of the two intersecting storylines of this movie, because you can tell Kawashima cares about Harue as she kind of spirals. It's never explicitly said that she goes into a red room, though I think she has her own kind of view on the world that leads her to do what she ends up doing towards the end of this film. But Kawashima comes over to Harue's place and she's like, you know, why did they leave? They always leave me. Potentially like she has like abandonment issues. And she's like, you know, it's raining and she's like soaking wet. And she's like, hey, let's get inside. Like I'm here. Like I'm not going to leave you. And they go inside. And I think this is the scene. It could be a scene later on. I'm not 100% sure, but she has all these computer screens and she, I believe because Kawashima showed her this website, she finds all these cameras and she kind of talks about like, earlier before she turns on all these screens, she's like, you know, I've always kind of wondered what death is like. And this is, I think, the scene where he is like, you know, why worry about death? Like, I want to live forever and such. And kind of talks about ghosts a little bit, but she turns on all these TVs, all these computer screens, and she says, are these people really living or are they ghosts? And again, it's never fully confirmed if these are actual people that you see through this like ghost website or if these are people who have died and these are their ghosts that are lingering in these forbidden rooms. But she's like, are these people really living? And it's all people at their computers. And it's kind of to talk of like, you know, it's kind of ironic me talking about this. You know, the irony isn't lost on me sitting in front of my computer and speaking about how people isolate themselves and tend to stay in all day. And there's a term that's used in Japan called a NEET, N-E-E-T, which are people who like don't work and they stay inside all day and, you know, watch anime, play video games and such, and don't really have a job and all that. Granted, you know, I go out and I do things, so it's a little bit different for me. But she kind of talks about, like, you know, is this really living? And I don't know how this scene leads into the next, but Kawashima is at this kind of pachinko bar, which if you don't know what a pachinko is, it's kind of like a slot machine thing where you buy these metal balls and you put the metal balls in and you get, like, different points and kind of like gambling. You get different points and depending on your points, you get so much money or so many pachinko balls, which it's like a weird loophole in Japan to gamble. Because you earn pachinko balls through the pachinko machines and then you sell back your balls so you can like make more money per se. And it's not explicitly gambling, but it looks like he's in a pachinko bar and, you know, he encounters another ghost and eventually Harue outside and she says, I want to get away from here. Let's just go and get away and leave. He's like, okay, let's do that. And they get on a train and you know, they kind of have a back and forth of like, there's no one on this train and it's kind of weird. And, you know, the train just stops suddenly out of nowhere. And this is kind of a little bit of a cool scene, but he's like, hey, she's like, I gotta go back. I have to, like, what am I doing? I have to go back. And he's like, no. She's like, this is like the last stop. And he's like, no, it's okay. I don't think this is the last stop. I'll go talk to the driver. Just stay right here. I'll go talk to the driver and we'll probably be on our way. And eventually she leaves the train and kind of just disappears. I don't want to, not like disappears from the movie, but like kind of disappears from the scene. Kawashima doesn't know where she went. And there's like a really cool, as I said, Red kind of sneaks its way into a lot of these scenes, but it's very foggy outside. And there's this like red light that's in the bottom right-hand corner of the screen, just kind of flashing red. And I don't know, it just adds like a little bit of a extra hidden color. Something I need to go back to with Michi's storyline. I believe it's a Michi storyline. She's watching TV and it talks about how these people in Tokyo are disappearing. For the most part, kind of youngish people, some really young, like 4 or 5 years old. But there are people in Tokyo that are going missing. And, you know, the entire time we're watching it, I think it's about like 2 minutes of just people saying that they're missing. And as Michi walks away, it's just still talking about how people are missing. And this kind of ties into the ending of this movie. Where do I want to get into spoilers? I think so. I think I'm going to start talking about the end of this movie. So spoilers, again, I really recommend you go and watch this movie. But yeah, we're getting into spoilers now. So we learn that Harue eventually makes her way back into her apartment and sees what Kawashima saw earlier in the movie, of the guy with the bag in his head and in the wheelchair. Well, when we saw it from Kawashima turned it off before he saw the whole thing, but he wheels over, takes off the bag, and takes a gun and shoots himself. And after that, Harue sees a video of herself being looked at from behind. And, you know, she goes into the room and I would assume sees a ghost. We don't see the ghost itself, but she's like, oh, I'm no longer alone. And like grabs the face of this ghost. And that's kind of the last time where we see her. Kawashima then goes over to her house and is like, hey, like, what if we live together? You won't be alone. You know, you can try this with me and, you know, you won't be alone. We can live together. And as I said, Kawashima, I do think really cares. So Harue, and eventually busts through her door and sees the help me written all over her wall. Actually, I don't think it's written there yet because this is where, Kawashima and Michi's storyline start intersecting, and Kawashima, after not being able to find Harue, is just walking, and Michi's car is broken down, and she's like asleep in the car, and is like, hey, you need help. And as Kawashima's repairing her car, they kind of get to talking, and it's like, do you have any many friends? And he's like, well, maybe one. And he's talking about Harue, and it's like, oh, what is she like? And Kawashima's like, I don't really know. I never really got the chance to really figure that out. And she's like, well, let's go find her. And that's when they go back to the house, and that's where it's like, help me all over. And she's like, well, there's like an industrial plant over there. Let's go check out that industrial plant. She might be over there. And eventually Harue is there, and she has that black plastic bag over her head. And Kawashima's like, hey, let's just like leave together. Like, we, you know, you're not alone, and like we can leave together. And she's like, together, huh? And like throws something, and again, like shoots herself, like much like in the video. And it's not like gory or explicit or anything. Like, there, I don't even think there's even blood on her, even though she very obviously shoots herself in the head. And you know, some things go down. They carry her body outside, and Michi's car is out of gas, and Kawashima's like, don't worry, I think I saw some gas inside, I'll go get some gas and be back. And that's where he has his experience. He goes into a forbidden room. I don't know, at this point in time where like the ghosts are more stronger and are able to like like occupy a space, because the door for the forbidden room, even though it's taped closed, like opens on its own. So I don't know if like the ghosts are more powerful and can entice people to come into these forbidden rooms a little bit easier. But Kawashima goes in because he drops the gas cap inside of this room. And, you know, even though he told Michi that he knows about forbidden rooms, ends up going in anyway. But we get this ghost, and this is actually a really cool scene where Kawashima's like, you're not real. You're an illusion. You know, I don't believe in you. And the ghost is like, well, I'm real. I'm not an illusion. I am here. And Kawashima eventually falls down, and there's a scene where this ghost like kind of glitches towards him. And again, it's very, you can't see its face. You can see like a semblance of a face, but it's not very clear until like this ghost gets like right up in the camera and its eyes become visible. And I think at this point, I don't know if I want to call it a curse, but for lack of a better term, Kawashima at this point is cursed. And we learn that the world is falling apart. And I think it's because the ghosts have such an influence and are taking up so many spaces in the world now that people are just kind of like mass suicide, killing themselves. And like Tokyo is kind of falling apart and there are fires everywhere as they're like driving down, because Michi eventually finds Kawashima and they drive off. And like the world is effectively kind of ending because of these ghosts are coming into the world. And, you know, as I said, there's like fires everywhere, and eventually they stop and Michi's like crying and Kawashima's like, no, I'm okay. Like, let's just go as far as we can. And she's like, well, okay. And they find this boat, they get on the boat, can't find the key. So Michi's like, I'll be right back. And goes and find this key. But on the inside, there's like almost like burnt corpses. We kind of see corpses throughout the entire like town as they're driving. And there's even like at one point, I think when they're on the boat after they get the key, like there's a plane overhead that's like crashing and such. And they get on this boat and drive away, and that's where we kind of get back into the beginning of this movie where it's all these characters on a boat. And that's where we get like a Koji Yakusho and stuff. And there's a scene where Michi and the ship captain are talking, and again, when people walk off frame, it's a very bad thing. There's a scene where Michi like walks off frame, and I was convinced that she was going to be gone, just like jump off the side of the boat, whether it be like from the depression of losing so many people and just, you know, ending it. But thankfully she doesn't. And again, that's like one of the instances where it plays on expectations. But this boat captain is like, hey, we're going to go to South America because that's the only place we're getting signal. And if, you know, there are people there, we'll go there. And if not, we'll find someplace else. And she asks like, you know, am I doing the right thing? And she's like, he's like, yeah, you're doing the right thing. And eventually we go down and we learn that, you know, Kawashima's gone because he got taken by ghost. Yeah, and the movie ends there. And that's a very basic retelling of this movie. I do think the strong suits of this movie are, you know, the look of this movie. There's a lot of great looking shots that I didn't go over in this movie. But again, there are things that I want, you know, I don't want you to watch this movie and be like, oh, I know all of it already. What's the point of watching, you know? But please go watch this movie. It's such a cool movie. I think it should be up there when talking about like staples of Japanese horror. And it's one that I urge you to go and watch. And I think you're going to have a good time with it, especially if you're a fan of Japanese horror. Yeah, that's my retelling of Pulse and kind of what I thought about it. And, you know, the first 20 minutes of this podcast had absolutely nothing to do with Pulse, but that's okay. We're kind of hitting the point where I'm going to start wrapping up here. But again, I urge you to watch this movie. Don't forget to, I'm mainly going to talk about Spotify, even though this podcast is on multiple platforms. Mainly going to talk about Spotify. Please rate on Spotify. There are comments. You can leave a comment on Spotify. I would really appreciate if you did that. I'm still working some things out when it comes to like a YouTube channel and maybe even an email you can send me a request through, and maybe some social media where you can interact with me. Hey, you know what? Fuck it. I have a Twitter page called @tacos. Hold on. Sorry. It's like my main Twitter, @tacoscoffeeshop. That's TakusCoffeeShop. On Twitter, mainly tweeting about stuff over there all the time, like movies and such. You can go follow me there. And hopefully by next week, I'll have a like YouTube and an email set up where you can listen to this on YouTube and send me recommendations through that email. But for right now, I'm going to be wrapping this up here. But thank you so much for listening. If you made it this far, please go watch Pulse. I can't recommend it enough. And I hope you all have a great week. And I've been releasing... I released one bonus episode. Don't know if that's going to be an every week thing. But if not, I'll see you next week with another movie. And have a great week, everyone. Goodbye.